couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Spy Who Dumped Me, Christopher Robin, Darkest Minds, and Death of a Nation. I'll also talk about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup featuring a double bill of Tully and Star Wars Rebels Season 4. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big news that has been percolating this week, and it actually started just at the beginning of last week, and it missed being on the show, because I was talking about James Gunn and the whole thing, that took up the entire first news segment last week. So let's jump into the news that's been taking over a lot of movie watchers' perspective, and that is MoviePass. Now, if you don't know what MoviePass is, or was, because it seems to be crumbling as we speak, it's a subscription service that allows you to spend a certain amount of money and you get the ability to buy one ticket per day on this subscription to see a movie, supposedly anywhere. Originally, it was like $50 or something like that per month. And not too long ago, MoviePass said, hey, let's bump our subscription rates. And they brought it down to just $10 a month. Now, if you do the math, that doesn't work out from the beginning, because most movies, on average, just a regular evening full-price show is like $10. A little more, a little less, depending on if you do matinee or if you do like IMAX or something like that. And their membership just exploded. I mean, it went from something like, you know, tens of thousands to people to like millions of people. And a lot of people started to take advantage of it. And a lot of people jumped on that bandwagon because they knew that this was not going to last. You can't sustain that, because supposedly MoviePass would buy those tickets and then they have to find some way to financially cover it. And $10 a month, no matter, even if you have a 10 million subscribers, $10 a month isn't going to cover that many films. With a $50 a month thing kind of could work, because there's a lot of people that might just go to one movie a week. But you go to two movies a month, you blew out the $10 a month pricing anyways. And this past week, as Mission Impossible Fallout was getting ready to release, suddenly MoviePass went down. And nobody knew why when it happened. And I think it happened on Thursday night of last week. People wanted to go see Mission Impossible and wanted to use their MoviePass subscription, but the site wasn't working, and it was saying, oh, there was technical issues. Well, it came out that it wasn't that. It came out that they didn't have any money to cover the tickets they needed to buy. And so MoviePass scrambled and got like a $5 million loan to cover things and got themselves into the weekend. But even once you got into the weekend, they started having more problems. It went down a couple times. There are people reporting that Mission Impossible was completely blocked out from the subscription service. They couldn't buy those tickets. And then some of them had what's called surge pricing, which is a thing that most services will do when they start off too cheap and then they realize, oh, we have premium times. Uber does surge pricing in high traffic areas like airports, and especially if they're going to need more people and it's going to cost them more for drivers, they're just taking advantage. They're jacking up the price. And they started doing surge pricing for all Mission Impossible showings, not just the premium ones like 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. You're talking about 10 in the morning where there's like six people in the theater. You could still go buy a ticket to see these at just the box office with cash, but your subscription wasn't working. Then they'll have people thinking, what's going to happen with MoviePass? And then as we go rolling into the week, we're finding out that there's some stuff on the back end that they're having trouble with. And they were running at one point, I think they were running a $20 million a month deficit. And it was like Monday or Tuesday, it came out that they were telling people, well, you know, we might not be able to provide tickets for premium movies, for the top ones. And it's stuff like Christopher Robin comes out this weekend. People are expecting that to be pretty big. And earlier this week, they were saying, you may not be able to use MoviePass for Christopher Robin. So it suddenly went from being this great lickety-split, works all the time business to maybe working some of the time. And I saw people talking about how they were trying to buy tickets to like Hotel Transylvania 3, which had been out for a couple weeks, and it was a popular movie, but it's certainly not playing to sold out audiences anywhere, and then people couldn't get tickets to that. So the reality is people are saying, well, MoviePass is probably going to fall away. Now, of course, AMC, the theater company, decided to benefit from this a bit. It was kind of brilliant on their part, and they pushed their A-list subscriber. And that means you pay $20 a month, and you can see, I think, 3 movies a week or something like that, which is still really good, but it's less than half the movies you could see with MoviePass at twice the price. It's still $20 to see ostensibly 12 movies a month up to is still a fantastic deal, but AMC's setting its own prices for that. And, you know, people were striking at Netflix prices for the $10 a month unlimited movies or once a day to going to a little bit more like Amazon plus Netflix prices to see fewer movies. The reality is that MoviePass isn't going to survive. The big problem from theater distributors' perspectives is it may have damaged movie-watching habits. People are now used to saying, I can only pay $10 a month and see as many movies as I want. That can have two effects. The first effect is it might just cause people to not go to the movies anymore because they realize, hey, I'm either going to go see it for cheap or I'm just going to wait till it comes on demand or video. Or, and this is a way human beings think, it will justify in people's mind the low cost of $10 a month to the no cost of piracy. And they might justify that action better. I don't endorse piracy at all for movies, but I realize that if you're used to getting something for pennies on the dollar, you don't end up paying dollars for it later. I think the MoviePass may have been trying to change the habits of American theater goers, but I also think they may have been also just saying, hey, let's get this massive subscription list that we can then sell at a fire sale. It is not an uncommon practice for businesses to buy another company just to get the subscription base or their email list or something like that. Who knows? MoviePass may be done now, and I just don't realize it because I haven't read the news yet. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Missed this last week, so I thought I'd talk about a couple trailers. Now, we've got Operation Finale is the first one. Opens on August 29th.
We have our guy, Adolf Eichmann.
The architect of the final solution?
We should be putting him down like a mad dog.
I would happily put a bullet in between his eyes, but that's not what we're doing here.
My job was simple. Save the country I love from being destroyed. Is your job any different?
There are always a handful of movies about World War II and the Holocaust and the effect of the Nazi regime in history and in the world. So you get those every couple of years. This looks like it's going to be a big one. Got some great actors. Oscar Isaac. You got Ben Kingsley. You've got Nick Kroll playing a rare dramatic part. This looks like it might be quite interesting from a historical perspective. I always find these movies actually more interesting than the actual stuff that goes on during World War II because it's about the fallout and how people dealt with it. The next one I want to talk about really quickly is Hunter Killer, which opens on October 26th.
We've been ordered to cross waters that no American sub has ever crossed before.
We are witnessing the most aggressive military buildup in Russian history.
We've been keeping tabs on the Russian president
and his defense minister, Durov.
We're dealing with a single rogue minister.
What if we could free President Zakharin?
We rescue the Russian president.
We need eyes and ears on the ground.
Captain, waiting orders.
We're going in with 4 of our boys and get 1 Russian president.
Boy, it is not fall if you don't have some garbage action movie starring Gerard Butler. I think this looks terrible. This looks like, what was that one with Samuel L. Jackson as the president who was being hunted by terrorists in the snow-capped mountains? That feels like it's on that level. It doesn't look like it's particularly good, and I was surprised it's getting a theatrical release. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Death of a Nation and The Darkest Minds.
Thank you.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews and start off with Death of a Nation. Dinesh D'Souza examines the history of the political parties and how it relates to our modern political situation.
Lincoln was elected to unite a country and stop slavery. Democrats smeared him, went to war against him, assassinated him. Now their target is Trump.
America was never great! Slavery, genocide, and war!
Donald Trump wins the presidency.
So help me God.
They say he's killing America. Who are the real racists?
Full disclosure on this one. I do not think Dinesh D'Souza is a good filmmaker. Full stop. This is not about party. This is not about politics. This is not about ideology. I think he's garbage as a filmmaker, as a persuasive filmmaker. His stuff's at times incoherent and rambling and scattershot. He's sort of holding himself up as the conservative version of Michael Moore. For that matter, I think Michael Moore is a blowhard and an idiot too. I think he's got more raw talent than Dinesh D'Souza because he's able to sort of spin that kind of folksy, blue-collar, friendly atmosphere. But I still think that there's a lot of garbage in Michael Moore stuff. Again, that's not politics or party. That's just about filmmaking. First of all, I'm just going to throw this out there, the elephant in the room. It's very hard to watch a persuasive documentary by a convicted felon who has recently been fully pardoned by the president he's supporting in the documentary. Again, doesn't matter right or left on that one. There's clearly a connection between the two. But the problem with this movie is it starts out very much of the same reason I had problems with Fahrenheit 9/11. The problem with Fahrenheit 9/11 that I had, that started in the whole movie, the movie begins with this idyllic view of election 2000. And, oh, Gore was winning. And then Bush came in and stole it from him at the last minute, that dastardly person. I'm like, that's not how it happened. I remember sitting up late and watching the returns come in. That is not what happened in 2000. In 2000, it was Bush, then Gore, and they called this state for one, this state for the other, and then you had different networks calling different states and then uncalling states. It was chaos. There was no clear winner going into the night in the 2000 election, but Michael Moore presented that in the beginning of his documentary, and I always said, if you know, I lived through that and I watch it, if I know that that's not true, what he's saying at the beginning of a persuasive documentary, how can I believe anything he says? Because I know he's blatantly lying in the beginning of this. And I feel kind of the same way about this movie that Dinesh D'Souza did. It's very clearly him heaping praise on Trump and say, oh, definitively win this election. And it's not the first scene, but he does get to that point pretty quickly. Trump did not definitively win the 2016 election. I don't care what side you're on. Yes, he got the electoral votes. True. That absolutely is the truth. And that's why he's president. But he didn't win the popular vote. It was split. And also his party, the Republicans, being the party that wins the presidency, lost seats in the House and Senate. That's almost unheard of. In a strong, this is not what happened in like 1984, where Reagan just slaughtered Fritz Mondale and he got 13 electoral votes and it was a landslide, an avalanche for the popular vote and the Republicans gained seats in the House and Senate. That's a definitive victory. This was a significant victory for Trump and because the Republicans ended up getting the presidency and the two houses of Congress, but it's not like it was this overwhelming victory. I think it showed, if anything, that the results from 2016 showed how conflicted the country was, and very similar to 2000, how it showed neither of them were really crossing the aisle in terms of getting support by large numbers of people. And so that's sort of the premise that this movie's launching off, and then comparing Trump to Lincoln. And you know what? Half the movie is spent talking about how Lincoln was a Republican, and that's why Republicans aren't the racists. And I'm like, that was 150 years ago. I'm not saying one way or the other now, but my point is you can't sit there and say the proof that I'm not a racist is because 150 years ago, before I know anyone I know has lived and everyone in that time has died, that 150 years ago, this was the case. And therefore, I can't possibly be that way now. I mean, people do change and parties do change and ideologies change. This is like trying to convince me that Pabst Blue Ribbon is a blue ribbon beer because it won an award in like 1894. Now, if Pabst Blue Ribbon had won an award in the 21st century or even the 20th century, I might be able to be persuaded on that. But using a blue ribbon from the turn of the 19th to 20th century is not valid proof that the beer is an award-winning beer now. But half that movie is about, well, Lincoln was a Republican and the Democrats in the South were the bad guys and the racists and the plantation owners. And a whole chunk of the movie just seems to be D'Souza yelling, I'm not a racist, you're a racist. I'm not a Nazi, you're a Nazi. I mean, that's kind of all it is. And he uses a lot of, you know, he like leads down these paths and kind of muddles the waters and misuses terms and draws association because he's basically saying, well, because the Nazis were the National Socialist Party. And who doesn't know that? Who doesn't know that's what Nazi stands for? But he's like, oh, but they were socialists. So anybody who has a socialist tendency, I'm like, well, that's not, you're really ignoring a lot of nuance and great differences in this. And there's like this golf cart of topics he has to hit. He's got to say, oh, well, you know, Hitler was anti-gay. And, the worst thing that Joseph Mengele did was become an abortion doctor afterwards. I mean, really, that's the worst thing? Maybe all the horrible experiments he did in the concentration camp was probably maybe a little bit worse than just being an abortion doctor. I mean, this movie is this scattershot of kind of crazy and conspiracy theory and pick and choose policy. I mean, even stuff like he talks about how terrible political correctness is and then shows a picture of Kathy Griffin and with the head of Trump. And I'm like, well, wait, she wasn't taken down by liberals and political correctness. She was taken down by people who were offended for Trump. I mean, so he does this weird little bait and switch constantly. And nothing's more indicative of what a mess this movie is than his interview with Richard Spencer, where it starts off with him asking some bizarrely leading yet kind of rambling question, isn't it true or wouldn't you agree? And then Spencer starting to answer it and then him interrupting and answering another, asking him another rambling question that kind of doesn't have any bearing on the previous one. That goes on for like 5 minutes. For any sort of critical inquiry, it's kind of a mess. It's a hodgepodge of ideas at best. And it's about as garbage as Fahrenheit 9/11. I kind of put them both on the same level. So I'm going to have to say that Death of a Nation sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Real quick, I'm going to talk Darkest Minds. In a dystopian future, teens have developed special abilities and are rounded up by the government and put into camps.
Soon, there wouldn't be any kids anywhere. The government wasn't afraid of what happened to the ones that didn't make it. They were afraid of us. Because the ones that survived changed.
Ruby, you are very rare. Among the most powerful.
We know our time is near.
We're going to a place where kids can live together on the outside.
This wasn't screened. It reminds me a lot of The Fifth Wave, which was a terrible movie. I think if this had been made about the time the first Maze Runner had come out, it might click better. But just right now, it just seems like it's kind of has been an old hat. So I'm going to have to say it gets a preemptive suck. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Spy Who Dumped Me and Christopher Robin. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with one of the big ones that's going to be kind of topping the box office this weekend. And that is The Spy Who Dumped Me. A woman is dumped by her boyfriend, who turns out to be a spy. Big surprise. Only to find herself and her best friend dragged into an international world of intrigue.
My boyfriend dumped me in a text.
In the bear situation.
We just want to talk about Drew Thayer. He's your boyfriend, right?
Drew CIA.
I'm sorry, what? I know you're a spy.
It's a long story, and I'm going to explain everything. Some bad people are after me, and now they're after you.
If we don't deliver this package to Vienna, a lot of people are going to die.
Is this really happening?
Yeah, because you dated a spy.
There's sort of this subgenre of comedy that's basically a spy comedy. Stuff like Spy with Melissa McCarthy or The Hitman's Bodyguard, where they're essentially broad comedies. They are billed 100% as a comedy. But they are also an action movie. They're kind of this bona fide action movie, really. I mean, the problems that I had with, say, Spy were not about the action and the international chase sequences. Those were actually quite good. They tend to be relatively competent action movies. And it's funny because I went and saw this. I actually saw this on Girls Night Out. I look kind of weird going to that. The big bearded chubby guy alone in a theater of women, you know, having a Girls Night Out. And it was last Friday. It was an AMC thing. So I got an early chance at seeing this movie. And I looked up the running time and it was close to 2 hours. And I was on Twitter and I said that to somebody had asked about how long it was, and I said it was almost 2 hours. And like, how these movies, comedy should only be an hour and a half, really, 95 minutes tops. I'm like, well, it's not. I mean, it is a comedy. It's completely a comedy. It's set up as a comedy, but it's also an action movie as well. And the reason these tend to be longer is because you have the comedy goings on. And then in the middle of it, you have a big long car chase that maybe takes 5 or 10 minutes, or you have some big running sequence, or you have a shootout. They have a bunch of those in this movie. And I remember seeing that in The Hitman's Bodyguard has some really bona fide good action sequences in it. Same thing with Spy, but then you have the absurd silliness. And I mean, I'm not talking about like spoof level of stuff like Austin Powers. These are movies that they're spy movies, but they just are a comic story. I actually kind of like these types of movies. I'm a softie to that. And that's actually what I appreciate about The Spy Who Dumped Me. Now, from the action side, I mean, it's not like wall-to-wall action. It's not like Mission Impossible Fallout. It's not like a James Bond movie in the sense that you have these set pieces that took months and months and months to film and are really what's hinging the movie together. It's not that high of production value. But like, there's a scene in there where Kate McKinnon and Mila Kunis are driving this car and they're trying to escape from the bad guys and there's a big car chase. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of cool. They're not hanging off of a helicopter the way Tom Cruise was. But, you know, hey, these still work. As a comedy, it's okay. I didn't hate it. I thought I was going to hate this movie. It doesn't necessarily play to my interests. But Mila Kunis is fine. I think she's grown into herself as an actor. It's sort of picking these roles like Bad Moms and this, where she is the... Even as though she's like totally gorgeous, she can kind of play the average person who's kind of in the background and just dealing with life. Kate McKinnon, I can take Kate McKinnon in small doses, and I think she's brilliant. You know, watch Saturday Night Live, and you see some of these sketches, and she just nails it. She, at times in these sketches, is brilliant. Some of the best sketch comedy acting you're going to see. She is one of those SNL comedians that goes back to the old days. People like John Belushi or Dan Aykroyd or Eddie Murphy or Chevy Chase or... They were the indelible Saturday Night Live comedians. Like Will Ferrell getting his start in Saturday Night Live. He was brilliant in almost everything he did as a comedian. The difference with Kate McKinnon and some of these other actors is I can't take Kate McKinnon's shtick for 2 hours. Every movie I've seen her in, she's funny for about 5 minutes and then it just gets old. And I know there are people out there who are like, Kate McKinnon's my spirit animal. I remember when Ghostbusters came out and there are people like gushing over Kate McKinnon. I'm like, yeah, she had some funny bits, but then you try to carry her sort of goofy off the wall absurdity out of the box too long and it just doesn't weather that storm. So any scene in the movie with her, she's actually kind of funny, but it just wears on you after a while. And they have some other great actors. They like got Hasan Minhaj in there, and he's from The Daily Show. He's got a bit part. I think he's quite funny in the film. It's very small. Like they got Gillian Anderson playing the CIA boss or the MI6 boss. You can kind of come and go with. I think Gillian Anderson has had so much work done on her face that she can't emote or actually. And I saw that with the X-Files, this last run of the X-Files. She didn't look authentic because she looked, you know, like a porcelain doll. Anyways, Spy Who Dumped Me is fine. It has both of the things in it. It has the action stuff, and it has some funny romantic relationship comedy stuff that works. It's not great, but it's not like a, you know, groundbreaking Nora Ephron type rom-com either. For a lark, for Girls Night Out, it's totally fine. So I'm going to have to say The Spy Who Dumped Me kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Christopher Robin really quick. After growing up to be a no-nonsense businessman, Christopher Robin is reunited with Winnie the Pooh and the adorable characters from the 100-Acre Wood.
What should happen if you forget about me?
Silly old bear.
I won't ever forget about you, Pooh. I promise. Not even when I'm 100.
We should be working this weekend, Robin.
But I promised my wife and daughter I'd take them away this weekend.
The tree I remember was in the countryside, not here in London. There's no opening.
I suppose it's where it needs to be.
Well, that's a silly explanation.
Why are you here?
Oh, yes, I need your help. I've lost all of my friends.
I'm kind of conflicted on this one, because there's parts of this movie that are absolutely adorable. All the stuff with the stuffed animals, with Pooh and Tigger and Piglet and Eeyore. Eeyore's great in this. Eeyore's always like been my favorite because he's... I mean, he's like one step away from committing suicide throughout the movie. I mean, he kind of does. He does just half-heartedly attempts, but he just doesn't have the drive to follow through with it sometimes, even with some of the things he said. I've always thought he was funny. Rabbit always annoys me, even though he's voiced by Peter Capaldi. He's voiced by Doctor Who in this. But Rabbit has a bit part. Owl has a bit part in it. But, you know, of course, they have the main stage. You got Pooh, Piglet, Eeyore, and Tigger, of course, as the ones that really interact. Now, when it's got those stuffed animals in it, it is adorable and charming and wonderful and everything that's great about Winnie the Pooh. And it's also something that touches your childhood, that makes you remember what it was like to see these movies when you're a kid. And they really do, because it's Disney, and Disney's been doing this stuff for a while. They know how to do the Winnie the Pooh thing. It feels like an authentically live action, even though it's CGI, but it feels like this authentic live action version of the cartoons you saw, you know, the blustery day and all. But at the same time, there's parts of the movie that are really tough to get through. The first half hour of this movie is rough. Like, it starts off really cool with the animals, and then you have Christopher Robin growing up, and it just beats any sort of life or optimism out of you as you're watching Christopher Robin become not a kid. And it just gets depressing, and he's not a good father. And when he finally rediscovers the animals, then it lightens up and it becomes a wonderful little whimsical story. I mean, on the level of like Paddington, with them running around London trying to save his job. So I'm conflicted. There's parts of it that are wonderful and great and are going to connect with kids, and it's a sweet little adorable, lovable movie. But you just got to get through that like first half hour or 40 minutes. That even when Pooh shows up, it's really depressing and really dark. And the only thing that keeps that going is Pooh has these sort of lilting things he says, which are fun. And that's what makes Pooh such a great character. And in a way, I would have rather seen a full-blown Winnie the Pooh live-action movie where Christopher Robin was a secondary character, or just him growing up and having it in the 100-Acre Wood. It was trying to kind of do both that got in the way. But if you're going to have a movie that the first half is tough to get through and the second half's really fun and breezy, that's the way to do it. You don't want to start off fun and breezy and have the last half be a slag. So still, ultimately, I'm going to give it a kind of rocks. It's a charming, wonderful little movie. It's just you got to get through the tough part in the beginning.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Tully and Star Wars Rebels Season 4. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office. Mission Impossible had no problem topping the box office this past weekend with a franchise best of $61 million. Now, let's deconstruct that franchise best really quickly. I love when people take a movie that started 20 years ago, a series, and say, it's the biggest opening ever for a Mission Impossible movie. And yeah, it is. True, and that's great. I'm not trying to take anything away from this Mission Impossible opening weekend. However, comparing it to the original movie, which had an opening weekend of $45 million. That was the first Mission Impossible. And then the second Mission Impossible had an opening weekend of $57 million. To say that $61 million is the highest that the franchise ever done, and that's true for an opening weekend movie, but we saw this with Ocean's 8, where they're saying Ocean's 8 is the best opening of all the Ocean's movies. Well, the first Ocean movie came out in, what, 2000? Almost 20 years ago. And then the second one came out a couple years after that. So when you adjust for inflation, it didn't sell the most tickets. So let's just put that aside. It's not the biggest opening weekend. It is the biggest number, but it is also showing that the original Mission Impossible was a bigger hit from the start, and Mission Impossible 2 and so on. That's not to take anything away. $61 million for an opening weekend for an action movie is perfectly fine. And that's good. And I think that's being reported well. And I think it's going to have good legs. It's the last big action movie of the summer. I'm not even counting The Spy Who Dumped Me. So yeah, that did well. But let's not get ahead of ourselves and declare it a bigger bona fide hit and bigger for Tom Cruise's career than the first Mission Impossible. Teen Titans Go to the Movies came in number 5 with $10.5 million. Not bad for just a kid's movie, especially for a cartoon that's aimed just squarely at young children. It's not even skewing older, except for it skews older the way that the Powerpuff Girls skewed older. There's a lot of college students and adults that would watch Powerpuff Girls, but let us make no mistake, that was a show that was aimed at kids, little kids. Mamma Mia and Equalizer 2 are ticking down. Mamma Mia is, I think, having a higher drop-off rate than they expected. It's dropping at well over 50% a week. I'm not surprised by that, because you tend to get that with a sequel that is less warranted. And I think if this had come out earlier, closer to the original Mamma Mia, you would have had less of a drop-off. But there you go. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I want to cover two movies today. The first one is Tully. Jason Reitman directs this. It was written by Diablo Cody. It came out a couple months ago, and it never got screened here, but I finally got a chance to see it on Blu-ray. After the birth of her third child, an overworked housewife gets a nighttime nanny who becomes a close and unexpected friend.
Hey, frozen pizza, awesome.
Hello. I'm Tully. I'm here to take care of you.
Tully's one of those movies that got a lot of buzz, and it did quite well. It's got like a Rotten Tomato score of like 87%, but I don't affect that score. If I did, it would not be as high. Here's the thing about Tully. It's a movie about parenthood. And I'm not just a parent. I was a stay-at-home dad for the big first chunk of my kids' lives. I mean, I have teenagers now, but I, you know, like first 10 years of their life, you're kind of there hands-on with them. And my youngest kid is 10 now, and so he's kind of moving towards the tween years, or he's in the tween years. He's moving towards teenager years. He's more self-sufficient. They don't need somebody around every minute of the day. But I take a lot of issue with parenting movies that are basically a screenwriter or director's crappy ability to be a parent put on screen, and we're supposed to think that that's normal. I hated every single adult in this film. I mean, the kids, and even some of the kids, like the little baby, the baby's adorable because it's a baby. You know, babies are designed to be cute. But she was terrible because she was a mess. And yeah, postpartum depression and all that. I understand that. I understand that's a real thing. But it's 2018, people. Other people realize it's a thing. Go to your freaking doctor. They've got like their youngest son. He's clearly has some developmental disorder. He's clearly somewhere in the autism spectrum, or he's got Asperger's or something. Pretty extreme elements. And they're like at the school, and they're like, well, he's quirky. And she's like, what do you mean quirky? Are you saying he's retarded and blah, blah, blah? And they're like, no, he's just quirky. No, this kid has diagnosable problems that need to be addressed. And by not addressing them and not diagnosing them, you're being a bad parent. And she like go like to a private school, but she wants to stay in the private school, but the private school's not equipped to deal with the emotional development issues that this child has. And at no point do they address the elephant in the room and saying, yeah, but if you go to their public schools that are equipped for this and have systems in place to take care of the needs of a special needs kid. This kid is special needs. And that's not a slight against the kid. You know, if you had a kid who had juvenile diabetes and you're just like, oh, he doesn't have diabetes. He just is quirky. No, diagnose the problem and address it. We're in 2018, people. There's these tools that we have and at our disposal, but people don't use them. And that's what irritates me about some of the parents. And it seems to be in this movie that that's okay. That's bad to do to your kid. Don't take offense if your teacher tells you, my wife's a teacher. If your teacher tells you that your kid is hyperactive or has difficulty focusing or, you know, could benefit from an intervention, listen to the doggone teacher. Why? Because they're an expert at that. And if you've got a kid that takes 40% of the teacher's time, that is not fair to the other 20 or 30 kids that they sometimes plow into these teachers' classrooms. They have programs in place that will take care of this. But if you refuse to do it because you don't want to label your kid as autistic, you're not doing your kid any favors. And that's one of the big things it irritated me about that. The father, who's played by Ron Livingston, he's a nice guy, but he's not very connected. He's not available. So, well, that's his problem. He's a bad parent. If you're a person who comes home from work, says hi to your family, and then goes upstairs to play video games and not deal with your wife and kids or your husband and kids, you're a bad parent and a bad spouse. I raised three kids. I know what this is like, and I'm a guy. So don't tell me it's like, oh, mothers have to do. No, I've done this myself. I haven't breastfed, true, but I've done everything else. This is how the system works. And that's part of the thing about this is it's Diablo Cody, and it's clearly she's venting all of her frustrations about being a mom when she's had kids. But all this does is this doesn't reveal to me the humanity in her life. This reveals that she's just a bad parent. And if Jason Reitman's like, this is good, I identify this. Well, you're a bad parent too. There's so much bad parenting going on in this movie that it distracts you from the truly terribly written, dumbed down, worst ending ever in a movie. This movie is really bona fide terrible. Legit one of the worst movies of the year. So Tully totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next one I want to talk about really quick is Star Wars Rebels Season 4. The fourth and final season of the Lucasfilm television series wraps up the story of a ragtag group of fighters against the Empire in the events leading up to A New Hope.
It was a simple story about a boy who was lost and a girl who was broken. I led them into battle against an evil so terrible it tried to black out the stars. We fought for each other. We fought for those who could not. But we never imagined it would end like this.
I didn't follow Rebels, the storyline. I watched some of the Clone Wars. I know there are some people who really got into the Clone Wars, who like watched every episode. I didn't think it worked as well for series television. I like the big bombastic movies. Even something like Solo, I enjoyed. But I recognize that there was a lot of great stuff in the Clone Wars. But of course, when Disney took over, they shut that down. Now, apparently, they're bringing it back. And I think they shut that down and they said, let's do another series. And Rebels looks very much like, I mean, the design is very close to the Clone Wars. But it deals with a different group of people at a different time. And I love these enrichments to the Star Wars universe that they're doing. This is extended universe stuff. This is stuff you would have seen in like comic books and role-playing games, etc., you know, back in the 90s. And it's well done. I mean, they got decent characters and they interact well. And yeah, so if you liked the Clone Wars and you haven't given Rebels a try, give Rebels a try. Now they're probably going to bring back Clone Wars because the Rebels is over, but now they're doing it on Disney's watch. So they're going to make sure everything fits together, you know, as retconning becomes more and more complicated in this universe. So I'm going to say Star Wars Rebels Season 4 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Meg and Black Klansman. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.